All right, welcome everyone to our new seminar series on migration, politics, and political change. We decided to do this thematic seminar series as part of our Marie Curie research project on the same topic. And when we started this project a year ago, we found that there are quite many different takes on the relationship between migration and change as such, but especially on the relationship between migration and political change, that are not always in dialogue with each other. So us too, we were hired as the qualitative and the quantitative researcher to explore this topic from very different angles. And when we started our exploration, we are going to present what we have found so far, so a year after, with one more year to go, where are we standing now in our own exploration from those two sides. But this seminar is the result of the desire to enter into a dialogue about all those different approaches. So we have found a very exciting set of presenters that are centered around this topic, but approaching it from very different sides. And we hope that you will find the time to come to many of those of these seminars in this term. And we will open this seminar series by then presenting the preliminary results from, as I said, from both our explorations. Ali will start from his side, then I will take over, and then we'll talk a little bit about what we can expect from the rest of the series.
Okay, so thanks again. So my name is Ali Chaudhry. I'm a postdoctoral researcher here based at IMI. And as Marike said, we're doing this topic on migration, politics, political change. And what I want to do is just take about 10, 15 minutes just to kind of go over very broadly, very briefly in many ways, what the overall research program of what I'm looking at. And in terms of these speakers at the end, we're going to go through very briefly and talk about who these different people are and what some of their talks are going to be about to share that with you. So this project I'm working on has three different components. The first is developing a theory of migrant political action, and I want to try to share some of that today with you, some of the very preliminary efforts of trying to develop a theory of migrant political action, and to discuss that type of a project in and of itself, the limitations and the difficulties with that. The second part is a more quantitative research. One is looking at an analysis of immigrant, domestic, and transnational electoral politics. And in this research, the idea is to try to look at what is the relationship between politics in receiving countries and transnational politics in origin countries. This particular analysis looks primarily at voting, so only electoral politics. And I'll talk about that a little bit more. And then the third part of this project is a new project that hasn't even really started. It's going to be done with my colleague at IMI here, Yasser, and we're going to do a quantitative analysis of the effects of remittances on political attitudes in North Africa. So for this research, we'll be using the Arab Barometer survey, looking at a 2011 and 2013 wave to see what the effect is. So that's generally what I'm doing here during my postdoctoral fellowship. And now I'll talk a little bit about this first project on the immigrant, domestic, and transnational electoral politics. So the questions motivating this particular analysis is, what is the relationship between immigrant voting and receiving and origin country elections? The second question is, how do political opportunity structures in origin and receiving countries affect immigrants' voting behavior? This research represents the first comparative quantitative study of receiving and origin country voting among multiple migrant groups in Europe. So there are several studies that have emerged over the last 10 years looking at this topic, but most of them focus on one particular immigrant group, or at the most, two groups. And most of this research usually focuses on one country of destination. So while those studies have been very illuminating, and I've worked on some of these studies myself with Luis Guarnizo, they don't really enable you to see how do these different types of contexts vary, or how the variation across different receiving countries might affect voting behavior for immigrant groups. That's something that this analysis enables me to do, because there's multiple destinations, multiple immigrant groups. In particular, there's 14 migrant groups in the data set I'm using. And the data I'm working with comes from Laura Morales' comparative study that was done between 2004 and 2008, which looked at a variety of different political activities of migrants in different receiving areas in Europe, in particular, eight European destination cities. The analysis for this first part relies on multinomial logistic regression models, which basically predict and try to understand the determinants of voting behavior in receiving and origin countries. The key findings from this analysis are that the two processes, voting in your host country and voting with your homeland, are actually two different processes. Different factors determine whether you're going to engage in the politics of your receiving country or an origin country. And in particular, in the receiving end, citizenship, and this is kind of a no-brainer, right? Citizenship, having it is the key element you have to have in order to participate in electoral politics. When it comes to origin country politics, one of the key determinants is whether or not the origin state allows external voting from abroad. So if they have created an infrastructure to engage the diaspora and to bring the diaspora into institutional politics, then those migrants are more likely to vote in origin country elections. An interesting finding of this, which goes to two major debates in this literature, is that immigrants who participate in receiving country politics are also highly likely to engage in origin country politics. So there's an ongoing debate over the last 15 years in this research about whether being transnational is conducive to your integration. Is there a divide? Is there this issue of divided loyalties? Can you be integrating into a receiving society and maintain ties to your homeland? Can you do both those things, or do you need to pick? Is it a zero-sum game? And there's, of course, research that supports both those interpretations. What this analysis shows, looking at all these different groups across all these societies, is that those migrants that are highly politically motivated to vote are going to vote wherever they're given access to vote. So if that's eligibility to vote in receiving countries, they will vote. If they have eligibility to vote in origin countries, they'll vote there. And again, this is a minority, right? These are the people that want to exercise their political agency, if you will. Another interesting finding in this research was that membership in civil society organizations increases transnational political engagement. Integration policies at the city level increase this type of behavior. And finally, inclusive diaspora policies, as I just mentioned, external voting in particular, also increase transnational political engagement. So these are the key findings that have come from this first quantitative analysis. And I'm doing a very brief overview. I'm not going to go into the specifics. If you're interested, I can send anybody the paper if they'd like to look at it. It's about to be published as a working paper. And I can talk more about that in the Q&A. What I want to spend the rest of my time, brief time here, is actually talking more about this theoretical framework I'm trying to develop. And what I call it is a theory of migrant and diaspora political action. And I thought I should take a step back and figure out why even engage in this exercise of trying to come up with a social theory. So there's two reasons why I'm pursuing this. The first comes from my former mentor and advisor, Fred Block, who explained in his book, Post-Industrial Possibilities in 1987, when he went on this agenda of creating a theory of post-industrialization, that social theory and social science concepts are not simply analytic abstractions, but are themselves cultural tools that play an important role in creating semblance of order out of the potential chaos of social life. So that's always been a motivating factor for me, like why engage in coming up with theoretical ideas. Fred's motivations are plenty for me. And then the second motivation, or more inspiration, comes from the great Robert Merton and his notion of middle range theories. In 1949, Merton wrote, "Theories that lie between the minor but necessary working hypothesis that evolve into abundance during day-to-day research and the all-inclusive systematic efforts to develop a unified theory that will explain all the observed uniformities with social behavior, social organization, and social change." So he was explaining what is a middle range theory. And the way I interpret this is that, you know, these day-to-day hypotheses, for instance, education is highly correlated with occupational status. Okay, yeah, we see that in all the research we do all the time. And then these large macro theories like Parsonian functionalism or Marxism, that really, you know, those two things don't tell us much about the societies we live in as much as a theory that can bring the two together, something in the middle. And that's kind of what the task I've put for myself in terms of thinking about how to synthesize all the research that's been coming out on diasporas, transnationalism, immigrant collective action, and going for a more middle-range theory that can offer a conceptual theme that is adequate to consolidate group of special theories. So the task that I've put for myself in this is to synthesize disparate case studies of diasporas, transnational communities, and collective action into a middle-range theory of migrant collective action. So the key questions motivating this effort are, under which conditions do migrant communities engage in domestic and transnational political action? Why do some migrant groups engage in electoral politics while others gravitate towards civil society organizations? When and why do some migrant groups engage in non-institutional political action? In particular, here I'm talking about protests or revolutions. And finally, what is the relationship between domestic and transnational political action? So the first step in coming up with this was to define or to theorize what do we mean by political action. Now, in a lot of the research, a lot of it focuses really on electoral politics. It's really about voting, campaign contribution. Do remittances go up during election cycles? Do they go down? And there's a lot of questions of this. But what I try to do here is take a more robust view of this, or broader view, that, okay, there's institutional electoral politics. That's one domain of political action. However, what we see increasingly in the research is that civil societies and advocacy organizations play an also important role in advocating political action, whether in the receiving country or the origin country. And finally, what is probably the least studied amongst immigration researchers is the issue of civil disobedience, protest, and in extreme cases, armed conflict. So what are the conditions when a diaspora group or immigrant groups are going to engage in that form of political action? The general framework of understanding how this works, or what are the different forces that drive this, is depicted on this confusing image here. And the basic idea is that political opportunity structures, both in host and homeland country, are mediated by geopolitics, regional tensions, and of course bilateral ties. These all then funnel into diasporic engagement policies from the origin state, and they will then result in different types of political action. Now, these different boxes are not mutually exclusive, so we can find cases of diaspora migrant groups that are engaging in both electoral politics, civil society, and non-institutional forms of collective action, so protest. But what we wanted to do in this was to go a bit further, and I'm using the word we because I'm working on this with a co-author, Dana Moss, at the University of California, Irvine, who's a social movement scholar. And for us, the idea was that, okay, political opportunity structures matter. And the reason we're coming to that claim is that it's not really theorized that much in the immigration literature. When you look at transnationalism literature, it's a bit detached from social movement literature and other types of political science that really focuses on political opportunity structures. Well, these types of policies and issues in host and destination countries actually do matter. Access to citizenship, access to voting, open political competition, the right to assembly, the right to organize. So whether you have that or don't have that is going to definitely determine and shape the kind of political action that a group is going to engage in. What we wanted to do was take it a step further, and we wanted to think a little bit more about the origin state. Now, in the transnationalism literature over the last 15 years, a transnational turn, as Peggy Levitt talks about it, you know, there's always this like recognition that guess what, the origin state matters. The origin state matters, right? That the origin state's still there. We have to get rid of this receiving country bias. That's a very common theme that's discussed in IMI, the receiving country bias. So we always focus on the origin states, but there's very little theorizing about why does the origin state matter, or how does the origin state matter, in what ways does that work? And part of the issue is that there is very little research that compares different origin states. So in the case of diaspora political action, I argue it's very important to look at different types of origin states, different types of engagement policies for the diaspora, to then see how does that explain different forms of political action. So in terms of the origin states, we conceptualize them as four categories, and these aren't perfect. These are ideal types, and of course different states can occupy many of these categories at different times or at the same time. So one would be democratic, autocratic, in conflict, states that are in the middle of a conflict, and then non-existent states. And I was talking with our visiting fellow about this earlier, right? Diasporas that belong, that don't have a state, right? So the Kurds, the Catalanians, I mean, there's a couple other groups we can think of. The second part of this is the different types of diasporic engagement policies. Now, a lot of work was done by Alan Gamlin here, used to be here at University of Oxford, on this issue, as well as Michael Collier talking about diaspora engagement. But again, there's more of a focus on the celebratory or the positive or the active engagement of diasporas. There's also recognition of the symbolic engagements, where countries say, yeah, we like our diaspora, but they don't really work to integrate them into the actual origin country. And the least kind of research of these policies would be the diasporic engagement policies that seek to repress and control the diaspora. And that's something that's very key that I'm going to show in the work we're doing. Again, our idea here is that these two things will then determine whether diaspora migrant groups are engaging in electoral politics, civil society-led political action, or whether they engage in protest or in conflict. So again, going back to the origin state, so this is just, again, very tentative. I'm curious to get some comments on this. But, you know, we're thinking about, in terms of the autocratic case, we're thinking about the literature that's come out on diasporic immigrant politics. So we think of countries like China, North Korea, Sudan, Saudi Arabia, and we're basing this off the literature that's emerged on immigrant organizations, diasporic organizations. Now, is it a perfect autocracy? No, not in a political sense, political science sense. Where would the policy scores fly on it? Probably not very far. But if you look at the way that these states control through organizations, through advocacy organizations, their diaspora, we feel that maybe it fits there. We look at the democratic organizations, and states, and a lot of countries are classified as democracies, but we wanted to kind of think about it more in terms of strong and weak democratic states. And again, we're not political scientists, me and my co-authors, so this is all kind of new territory to us. But strong states, we're thinking again to the transnational literature, are states where people have high levels of transnational political engagement, especially institutional electoral politics. So states that don't have high levels of corruption, states where people actually feel their votes matter. And we can juxtapose that with weak democratic states. States where there's very low levels of electoral political action at the transnational level, even though people have access to do it. People just aren't engaging in it. Then, of course, we differentiate between states that are in conflict, and then finally, as I said earlier, the non-existent states. The tentative propositions that have emerged from this that we've tried to come up with are as follows. The first, democratic origin states seeking to actively integrate immigrants foster electoral political action. Two, democratic origin states seeking to only symbolically recognize immigrants foster civil society-led political action. Three, autocratic origin states using diasporic engagement as a means to control immigrants foster civil society-led political action and protest. And then four, origin states in conflict using diasporic engagement to oppress immigrants foster non-institutional political action, primarily in the form of protest, civil disobedience, and in some rare extreme cases, armed conflict. These are the cases that we're trying to theorize with these ideas. The first, and these are the people who've been working on this, and I'm putting myself in this, are democratic origin states making an effort to cultivate and integrate a diaspora, which generates high levels of transnational electoral political action. The Dominican Republic and Dominican migrants in North America and Europe are the classic case of this. It's been studied to death of people that are actively engaged. They actually have offices they can run for from abroad. So this is one case where we see this, how this works. The second one is the case that I did my PhD research on, which is the Pakistani diaspora. Here, we have a country that's also considered a democracy that symbolically engages as diaspora, but has not created any infrastructure for direct political engagement. And this has resulted in a large civil society sector, which is what's generally the main driver of political action. Another case, this comes from the work of Min Zhou and her graduate student, forgot the first name, Li, and they focus on China again, an autocratic origin state seeking to cultivate and control diaspora. This again is generating civil society-led political action and in some cases protest if people are at odds with what the Chinese government is doing. My co-author's work is on the Syrian activist diaspora in the United States and in Britain, and this research particularly looks at how origin states in conflict seek to repress and control the diaspora. And again, this generates a great deal of civil society-led political action and protests. So again, we're seeing a different type of political action here. And then finally, we're looking at cases and primarily trying to draw on the work of Nick Van Heer on Sri Lanka and seeing that origin states in conflict seeking to cultivate and engage diaspora will result in non-institutional political action in the case of protests and in the pre-2009 era, support for the armed conflict. So the tentative preliminary findings are that migrant and diasporic electoral political action is confined to origin-receiving countries with open and inclusive political opportunity structures. This would primarily be receiving areas in Western Europe, North America, some origin states like the Dominican Republic, Italy, perhaps some other places. But again, because it's electoral political action, it really only matters if the diaspora is large, right? If they have numbers enough to actually affect the politics in these places. Transnational electoral political action is the exception, not the rule. And this is interesting considering how much literature focuses on this topic, external voting, extraterritorial citizenship, you know, the different types of determinants of transnational voting. But for the most of the cases that we're looking at, it's very little electoral participation is happening. Most of it is focusing really on civil societies. So regardless of the origin state type, most transnational political action is occurring through civil society organizations. Autocratic and conflict states generate non-institutional collective action from immigrants and diasporas abroad. And finally, autocratic and some conflict states may use transnational social spaces to repress and control migrant political action. And this is, you know, we're really seeing a lot of this with Syria, with all of the activism going on, primarily in Washington, D.C. and in London, that there's an active effort to repress and control that. So I'll stop there and give the floor to my colleague, Mark.
Right, so switching a little bit to then my side of the or my approach to this, I started with thinking of, all right, we are supposed to study the relationship between migration and change and migration and political change more specifically, and that kind of came forward in view of the increased optimism of the expectation that migrants can contribute to change, to political change, that emerged since the mid-1990s, early 2000s, with the emergence of transnationalism, the idea that migrants can send back and forth all kinds of remittances, all kinds of ideas and capital back to their countries, and that that will have a positive influence. Now, since that the emergence of that debate has struggled, partly because of a lack of evidence and also very heterogeneous evidence that that is also hard to operationalize. So, how do you see change happening? How do you see development happening? Transformation? What is that? And how can you establish the relationship between migration and all of that? Other things that came forward was that if you go and look into it, you see both positive and negative change, but that is also problematic because what is, how can we normatively or analytically see the difference between positive and negative, right? Where positive, for example, would be in the political would be highlighted as a contribution to democracy, and negative would be contribution to more unequal power relations. But then again, how do we analytically distinguish between the positive and the negative? And third, there was quite some, you know, as we went, there was quite some suspicion of the, you know, the policy agendas behind stimulating this positive story of migration and change. So that has led in the past few years to maybe a swing back to pessimism, as some of our colleagues have called it. And I would say before we do that, while all of these, you know, struggles with the positive debate of migration and change are true and have to be taken seriously, before we swing back to pessimism, I argue that we have to find better analytical tools and better analytical tools to study this in a way that is that maybe gives us more solid, or you know, more a better overview of this relationship. So while we have been looking at very particular ways of looking at the relationship between migration and change, I argue that we need to take a holistic perspective on both the processes and the outcomes of migration, politics and political change. And with that, we have to start with what is politics. What is the political space? Then what changes and what are changes? What is political change? And what are levels of political change? Then how does the political change? And finally, then, you know, to zoom into that from wide to very narrow, what is then the role of migrants? And why would migrants contribute to any change in the political? So my part of this research is both a conceptual, a methodological, and an empirical exploration to study this. And to come back to the first question, what is politics? I've come up with this analytical framework that I won't bore you with how this framework came into being, because I did that last week at the conference. But I just would like to highlight the use of this framework here. So in my view, politics is everything that has to do with division of power in society. And this framework shows that the politics politics can be divided into different dimensions, defined by its relation to actors. So you've got political structures, which are defined as any forces external to and impacting on someone, so on an actor. So that's policies, laws, political systems, bureaucratic apparatus, but also norms, values, inequality, economic systems. So structures that are external to, but affect you. That's not all, in my opinion, because furthermore you have capacities which are seen as a source, any sources of power that are available to people and that can be contested. So if I have more knowledge, more networks, better education, documentation compared to other groups, I have more power in a certain field, and that is also political. So people with, you know, if that ends up, if a certain group of people ends up with more power, then that is also political. Third, there's desire. So that's the inherent, the motivations that live within people. So that what people want to do. So that can be political norms and values, but also ideas, ideology, aspirations. So everything that people want that motivate their vision of the political. Then there's agency, and which is the self-perceived capacity to achieve desires. So combining desires and capacities, what do you actually decide to do, and how much power do you have over your own decisions? So do I choose to act or not, and in which way? So that's for me a typology of the political. With which I'm going to go into the next question of what in all these political spheres changes, how does it change, and what is the role of migrants? So I'm using an empirical case study as a pilot for this exploration, and in order to empirically interrogate the questions on migration and change that looks at both the hopes and the fears, or both the positive and the negative, of the link between migration and change, I choose a case study that represents this diversity. So I chose the case study of Tunisia. Why Tunisia? Tunisia has gone through a diversity of changes, and therefore appeals to both those hopes and fears. So you've got multiple dimensions of change. You've got revolution, you've got transition, you've got stagnation and continuity. There is the tension between the democratic and the authoritarian. There is a tension between the secular and the religious in society. There is actions that are proactive and reactive. So all of this you can see in Tunisia, and I don't want to stay too long with the, you know, the context of Tunisia, but we've all kind of, you know, we all kind of know the background of Tunisia, where 5 years ago a revolution took place, and after that a transition into democratic change. But of course there's much more to it that we will very briefly explore here, and then to see how do these changes relate to each other, and how do these changes then relate to migration. And how, which is, you know, maybe a key question in taking such a holistic approach, how do you study these very wide questions in a useful way? And as this is a pilot study, I also want to see how can I do this in a way that can be replicated and can be comparable. So a bit, some words about the methodology then. As I said, a pilot study that can be replicated and comparative means that I need an exploration that doesn't require a full ethnography or decades of knowledge of a certain place, and something that can be replicated across cases. So I came up with the following. Rather than centralizing migrants from the start, I wanted to start from change. Started with the literature on one hand, and a mapping of online activism on the other, to identify the key dimensions of change that are being mentioned in both the literature and in online activism that came forward. So a very broad exploration of what is mentioned if you look at if you search for search for Tunisia and change. From there, I identified a number of broad key topics with which I went into the next phase of identifying the key outcomes, processes, and actors of change. And for that, I went in November to Tunisia to talk to a range of experts. And experts were identified as people being professionally observing change in Tunisia, so academics, civil society members, people from media, those kind of people, on those different dimensions. And I asked them, again, four broad questions. What has changed in the past 10 years, I said, in Tunisia? How did this change? Who contributed to this change? And finally, towards the end of those talks, what is the role of mobility then? And while these are very open questions, I used timelines as a way to focus these interviews, which worked quite well, and I'm happy to explain a bit more about timelines if anyone's interested. So and then the final phase would be if we explore the role of mobility in all those changes, to explore what makes migrants different, or why? What is a migrant change maker compared to a non-migrant change maker? So, but that is a next step that I will that is not yet finished, but I will talk about it in a bit. First, as I said, from the literature review on Tunisia, refined by some expert interviews and the online exploration, I defined maybe eight dimensions of change. And I'll go briefly through them, because they can all be put in one of these four dimensions. So first, a change in the political class. So who is in power? The political parties or the regime that's in power? And we've seen a revolution here in the sense that in 2011, Ben Ali was sent away and another government came in place. But we also see a sense of continuity in the sense that we notice now that a part of the old political regime is coming back. And there's also a sense that, well, behind Ben Ali and the Ben Ali family is a kind of an old political class that is deciding who now to put back into the regime. So that is, one hand revolution, one hand continuity. So different levels of change. There's a political system which has changed from authoritarianism to democracy, and that's a process that since 2011, since the revolution, that this is a process of transition, which is going very, very slowly, but it's happening. And in 5 years' time, a lot of that has happened, but it's not complete at all. Then there's a geopolitical dimension, which is about natural resources, it's about climate. Tunisia is a country with a dry climate that is increasingly becoming more dry, which has political implications. It's also a place that used to have natural resources, gas, that ran out, and the country had to start importing gas, where it was used to be self-sufficient, and that's also quite an important element. Then there's the element of the political economy. So the division between public, private, informal, and international roles, and the role of the country in the world economy. And here's what we say: the political economic system hasn't changed. So people say, well, a lot has changed, but this is a continuity. Nobody is challenging this division. And in the current, or in the kind of aftermath of the global economic crisis, there's even a stagnation, and this is problematic in that sense. Another dimension is, so as I said, political ideologies and ideas. There are some big debates or differences in the political sphere on what people think of nationalism versus pan-Arabism, secularism versus Islamism, liberalism versus socialism, so the big isms, so to say. But there's also, and they have always, they have been there politically. There's been these political divisions that are still there in people. It's just, the power divisions are different now. But there's a transition in the sense of political values. So where people used to comply a lot to, for example, the authoritarian regime in exchange for a sense of stability, people are not taking the authority of the regime, for example, of the central regime. They're not taking that for granted anymore, and they really, want freedom of speech, freedom to speak up, and that's what people really say. If anything has changed, is that people won't be silenced anymore. So that's a transition, or maybe even a revolution. Then on the capacity level, there's the sense of the dimension of the inclusion or the exclusion of groups. This is about, in Tunisia, it's about gender, it's about class, it's about religion and region. So on one hand, previously oppressed groups after the revolution have more freedom. So especially the political religious groups, and I mean any kind of political opposition now has also the power to speak up, but there's still a lot of inequality in terms of class and in terms of regional differences. So there's revolution and continuity there. There's also a change, and this is a true revolution, in the spaces of power. So the role of different spaces of power. So first, the role of the state was everything, was all encompassing, and became stronger in the regime of Ben Ali. After the revolution, civil society has mushroomed. There's lots of opposition groups, and there's also a big role of social media that has diversified the spaces of power, and that's also a very revolutionary change, I would say. Then on the level of agency, there's ways of engagement. So, as I said, proactive, so pressure, lobby, funding things, entering into dialogues, and reactive in terms of protesting, rejecting, disengaging from the political sphere. And here you also see a revolution in the sense that people are just active, and anything you can disagree on opinion on, that people enter into a strike, into a hunger strike, into a massive demonstration. So this is also quite big. By zooming into each of these dimensions, we can identify different processes happening between structures, capacity, desires, and agency that each influence each other. So I'm currently building my understanding of this to connect all these dots. And this analysis is by no means complete. In fact, I haven't entered into much analysis since I was there in November. But this is just an example of how all these dimensions play into each other. So the most well-known change is that is the revolution in Tunisia, and how does that happen? So we first have the Ben Ali regime family, having been in power for a long time, were increasingly keen to secure that power and increasingly excluded other groups. So the space for other groups became increasingly small. But also, historically, as I said, the dry climate of Tunisia with unreliable domestic production also always meant that Tunisia relied on the export of goods and labor, leading to a long history of mobility. And an outward-looking economy, so to say. This also meant that when the global economic crisis hit Europe, This also affected Tunisia's exports of these goods and labor, decreasing Tunisia's socio-economic capacities. Also, despite the authoritarian regime, the fact that this link to the outside world meant that the regime couldn't really prevent the rise of the internet and the increasing role of social media. They couldn't really censor that, and this provided a space of power. Although in Tunisia, many people had been accepting the limited freedoms under the authoritarian regime, this increased inclusion and increased space of power made their shift into a need for dignity and freedom and rights. So there was an increasing shift in desires. This then increased capacities and desires, which led to increasing protests and people showing the discontent towards the current regime. With some in-between steps that I won't elaborate on here, this then led to the fall of the Ben Ali regime. And And also in the aftermath of the revolution, although the political class tried to install new people from their, from their group and make things as much as possible as usual, the increased power of the people led to protests until democratic elections were organized. And from that moment in 2011 until now, which is exactly 5 years later, more developments kept unfolding in this constant changing process between structures, desires, capacities, and agencies. So this is like a moving framework where constantly things play into each other. And this is just a short example of that. So. I think political scientists specialized on Tunisia would probably laugh about such a simplified version of reality. And it doesn't say much about what started what, right? The point is that it's all very, very much influencing each other. So the chicken or the egg, don't ask me that question. But for this analysis, the goal is to get a general picture of how these dimensions play into each other, and then and the processes and the actors of change in Tunisia, in order to place the role of migration and mobility here. So that's what I'm going to do next. So the next question was, when I asked my experts this question, and they came up with different analysis that led to that previous picture, do you see a relationship between the role of Tunisians inside of Tunisia and the role of Tunisians outside of Tunisia? In all these dimensions of change, all these moments and all these actors of change. And this is where this framework can show that migration and mobility is an inherent part of change, rather than an independent variable as such. But if you look at it like that, it appeared that mobility was an inherent aspect of everything that happened and is still happening. So on a macro level, we've seen that mobility and the export of labor has been an inherent part of the political economy of the country, and the fact that this mobility was limited as a result of the global economic crisis increased pressure on domestic capacities and desires. Then on a micro level, we've seen migrants played a role in the sense that political individual figures went into exile to prevent going to prison or being tortured under the Ben Ali regime. And after the revolution, these people came back from exile, and came, especially the political Islamist leadership came back as a strongly organized party that won the elections and set up a government together with the people that had been in prison. But they had been able to organize their opposition from abroad. But also later, the government of technocrats that was put in place also largely existed of people who had been living abroad as exiles or migrants or expats in the international community. And we also now see people from the former Ben Ali regime, having lived abroad for a while, now coming back to again play their roles in the government. So in doing so, there's mixed evidence that these individual leaders bring democratic ideas from abroad, actually. Although this is one of the main hypotheses of the migration and political change element, this is not what I've seen now so far in this in this analysis. But just the fact that these elites are back and forth between things. And another, on the meta level, the abroad, so outside of Tunisia, provides a space for excluded groups, their organizations, their ideas and their actions to leave if there's no space for them to do their actions in Tunisia, to still be transnationally active, and to work from abroad and maybe come back later when the time is better. So this is kind of the way on the micro, meso and macro level that the links between migration and change. There's also the role of social media as a space of power has been instrumentally facilitated by Tunisians abroad, avoiding censorship by posting news messages on foreign websites and using proxy servers, and so that has been a strong link with mobility as well. So this overview shows that change in Tunisia takes place on different dimensions, on different levels of change, and is in many ways interrelated with mobility and migration, but not so much the explanatory variable. Now the next question would be if there is any qualitative difference between the kind of involvement of migrant activists or migrant actions and non-migrant activists. So the next step for me will be to, on each dimension of change, to identify migrant and non-migrant people that have been identified as active agents of change, to see what and how were the decisions to become active and what has been the role of their migration or not in that. And that may help me to see the role of migration in all of these trajectories. So that's where I am now, and I'm concluding with just some analytical benefits of this holistic approach to this question, see different dimensions of change, to see the cyclical structure, and to leave room for heterogeneity.